Hey, don't you wish you could go back to 1996, a time before smartphones and Twitter and a certain life-changing pandemic? Only one problem. The mid-90s was a pretty bleak time for coffee, and I don't know if I'm ready to give up freshly roasted premium coffee delivered regularly to my front door. Yep, I think I'll stick with the timeline that has Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always directly sourced and fairly traded. They offer blends and roasts to suit any taste, including decaf, half-calf, and a rotating seasonal blend. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor, and you will taste the difference. You can order Sparkplug as you need it or join the Sparkplug Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. No, it's fully flexible and customizable. All the convenience, none of the commitment, and it comes with all kinds of member benefits. And if you use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout, Sparkplug will give you 20% off your next coffee order. So what are you waiting for? It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the 361st edition of the Ellis's Analysis, the Monday morning review of classic motion pictures. Speaking of classics, if you dig on titles like The Godfather, Citizen Kane, A Streetcar Named Desire, and Star Wars, all of those and 119 more are part of the original Top 100 project way back in the archives, where we covered all 123 entries on the 1998 and 2007 AFI Top 100 lists. Heads up, you ape lovers, cause we spoil. I'm the ineffectual liberal jerk-off who's mentally divergent, Ryan Ellis. And here's the future insurance lady, my wife, Bev.
And that's me.
I'm in insurance. That's a great line for her. I think it's the last line of the whole film,
actually.
I was
just going to ask, is that the last line?
That anyone speaks, I believe it is, yeah. If it's not, it's definitely the last line that means anything. Maybe some just little chatter-type noises. Okay, the coming attractions, yet again, opinion question for 12 monkeys, a dozen apes. What's your favorite movie with monkeys in it?
I'll answer that by saying, get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape!
He can talk, and I can sing! That's a good choice, Planet of the Apes. You mean the 1968 version?
Yeah.
Well, the remakes are pretty good, too. The remakes and sequels are.
Yeah, I don't mind them, but they're not classics like the... OG.
Same year as that, 2001 A Space Odyssey had great monkey scenes in it.
Is that your favorite? Is that your choice?
Well, Apes and 2001 are easy choices because they're so great and classics and everything. We've covered them both way back in the archives. There's a rage monkey in 28 Days Later, very briefly, but it's a key part of the whole movie. It wouldn't happen if we're not for that rage monkey. You also got to love King Kong. Remake 2 is also pretty excellent in a lot of ways. Not perfect by any means, but we raved about Naomi Watts when we covered, I think, the original King Kong. But there's also 12 Monkeys. One of my favorite movies of the 90s. I guess I just like saying, monkey! Monkey! In homage to our lovely dead dog, our Pomeranian fox, who I would call a
Pomeranian.
Monkey. I would call him a monkey, and he didn't like it.
His favorite toy for years was a monkey. Mm. So,
I think I said originally that you have a monkey, and you are a monkey. And then my little running story in my head, it's, you're a monkey. Son of a bitch.
You were the one who was a monkey!
So all good choices. My very favorite... I don't really have one. I just like saying monkey. Okay, 12 Monkeys was released by Universal 25 years ago at Christmas time in 1995. It did pretty well here, and it did very well worldwide, which was not expected by a Terry Gilliam kind of film. Reminded me a little bit of the whole Spike Lee thing, where he would make, relatively speaking, hits, and yet still struggle to get budgets. Gilliam wasn't known as much as Lee was at one point, actually, for making profitable films, basically. So maybe that's why he struggled to get this one made, and then other movies in the future. Then again, I think his next movie was Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which, as I recall, was a gigantic dud, despite the fact that people rave about it so much now. Anyway, Bev, please give us the skinny on a very complicated movie called 12 Monkeys.
The year is 2035. Bruce Willis is James Cole, a prisoner in a post-apocalyptic society, forced underground by a pandemic that killed 5 billion people.
Sounds in 1996. Sounds a little familiar,
doesn't it? Yeah. Cole is selected to travel back in time to try and thwart the outbreak, but he gets put away in a madhouse for immediately telling people that he was sent from the future to thwart an outbreak. But when fate puts James in the path of the Army of the 12 Monkeys, the group responsible for the disastrous virus, he takes it upon himself to intervene with the help of his psychiatrist, Catherine, played by Madeline Stowe.
Although, according to the story he discovers, the 12 monkeys had nothing to do with it, just kids playing a prank. And also, you did say Madhouse, and we talked about Planet of the Apes only a few minutes ago. So, a madhouse! Or, in a nutshell, boy and his parents go to the airport, see someone get shot to death, then they get back in their car and go home.
Why don't they go anywhere? Why were they at the airport?
I think I've put this together before, but I really did this time, which is the young James goes to the airport. He talked about he was going on some kind of trip. As you point out, they're in the departures. They're not in the arrivals. It wasn't like they came from somewhere. You could argue that maybe it was edited together to make suggest that they went on their trip and then came back, but that doesn't really make a lot of sense. So they seem to go through and everything is fine and they're ready to go. Then all those terrible things happen and they leave.
Yep.
But of course, that great loop and Chris Marker, or maybe it's Marquet. I think he's French. La Jetée. It's based on his short story. And the basic idea there, I think it's a boy, but a person sees their own death and then goes through a loop where they're dying and they see themselves dying and then they go through it over and over again, which is, of course, what 12 Monkeys is all about. Or is it? Okay, some numbers and then we'll get into the conversation a little more thoroughly. The Rotten Tomatoes critics, 90% of them like this movie. 61 fresh, 7 rotten for an average of 7.6 out of 10. And 88% of audiences, and it has been, it isn't currently, but it's been on the brink many times, or in the 240, 250, that kind of thing, of the IMDb 250. It was 31st at the 1995 U.S. box office. Toy Story was number one that year. We covered that. Apollo 13, we covered that just a few months ago, was number three. Seven, one of the great movies ever as well, I think, really, was number nine, and we covered that one. And then Braveheart, the Best Picture winner, was 18th in 1995. 12 Monkeys was nominated for 2 Oscars. Best Supporting Actor, Brad Pitt, who won the Golden Globe. But the Oscar went to... Can you guess? You remember?
No, I don't remember.
His co-star in 7, Kevin Spacey. Huh? Mr. Tainted. And then Julie Weiss's costumes were also nominated for this movie. But no nominations for the sets, the cinematography, the sound, even that quirky music. I think especially the sets were very worthy. Okay, well, this has been a bit of an ordeal for Bev the last month, the movies that I've chosen. I didn't know she would dislike Almost Famous and even 12 Monkeys as much as she did, but I'll let you say what you think about Dos Apes.
Okay.
Dos would be 2, so Deuce, whatever, go ahead, 12 Monkeys, you know what I'm saying.
We take French here in Canada, not Spanish. So this is another one of those films that I admire it, but I just don't really like it. My feelings about it remind me a little of Inception, which we talked about just a couple of months ago. In a way that their strengths, so they're both very visually innovative films. I'm very, very fond of the look of this film. But both films, their weakness, which is the clumsy storytelling. It's an interesting story in both cases. Clumsily told. Story, I think, is king. So it's not that I don't like the film. It's just that every time I try to watch it, it just loses me. There's nothing that really pulls me in and engages me and makes me care about it. But... it's a cool movie. I can't deny it. And I don't want to yuck anybody's yum. We watched Godfather Part 3. That's just an objectively, let's say, mediocre film. Yeah. Disappointing film. And forgettable film. But I would never say that about this or Almost Famous. So it's mostly just a taste thing. But yes, I'm looking forward to watching something that, let's say, turns my crank a little more than the movies we've been watching lately.
After this, we start Scary Movie Month, and I think you've seen only half of the ones that we so far are slated. Maybe we'll change it up, but so far you've only seen 2 of those 4, but I think you like the 2 that I have chosen so far.
When you remind me what we've chosen,
we won't talk about it right now. You thought the story was a problem. I'm going to compare this to Whiplash. I've seen this so many times, I've seen Whiplash so many times, and I still don't know fully how I feel about either of them, and I like that. I like that I watch 12 Monkeys sometimes, even during the viewing, I'll change my mind and think, it really happened. He's sci-fi traveling. And maybe some things aren't quite what the movie's saying they are, but most of them are. Or this man is really just mentally divergent and none of it really happened and he didn't time travel. But they do throw those things in there where he predicted what would happen to the little boy down the well. And Catherine finally realizes, how did he know that? Well, he predicted it because he is from the future. And there are other things, of course, that tie this together as an actual story of time travel, Back to the Future, Terminator 2, whatever. Those movies are saying time travel happened. This one is way more spurious about it. But I love the fact that I'll watch it even after whatever this has been, the 7th viewing, and still not be fully sure. And that whole loop as well, where James sees his death and then he grows up and sees it again and again and again. And you said 2035, right? So it's supposed to be 40 years later. So he's mid-40s, I guess, in the future if there is one. But then he does things in both timelines that make you think either it's tying things together, which good movies do, like Back to the Future, for example. So much setup and payoff on that. But this one does a lot of setup and payoff too, but it also could be the sci-fi stuff isn't real because, for example, When he's in the madhouse, at night with Brad Pitt, he swallows a spider because he doesn't know what else to do with it. Well, the first thing, or one of the first things he finds in the future, when we see him exploring, he's all condomed up and he wears that spacesuit kind of thing so he can go up on the streets of Philly and look around in the snow and everything. If not the very first thing, one of the first things he finds is a spider and takes a specimen. We don't see the time travel tube that we do see, I think, twice later on until he sees something very similar, an MRI machine, in the mid-90s, or maybe it's the early 90s. But we see that when he's in the hospital, but only then do we later see the time travel tube type thing. He doesn't see the botanist, geologist, zoologist, astrophysicist, microbiologist that are in his future. We know that the astrophysicist, Jones, Carol Florence, who has that great line, she's in insurance, he doesn't know that she's on the plane, but she is now, I guess, traveled back too. So if we believe this is a time travel movie, then she is definitely time traveled, and so has Jose, who's given him the gun, which is why he gets caught by security and everything at the gate at the airport. And I think other people have time traveled too, if we're believing that's real. But there's a lot of little clues that it's not, including the fact that he is seemingly lost his mind. But one of the great things about this movie, he starts to think that he is insane and that none of what he's been saying was real. The future, the virus, any of that. Right at the time when the very intelligent, very grounded psychiatrist believes that it is. She didn't believe him at first. She feels bad for him. She also does say multiple times in this movie, I feel like I've seen him before. And then, of course, she realizes that she has seen him before because he's in the World War I book. He's in a picture from 1918 or something, World War I, where he couldn't have been unless he's time traveling.
Isn't that evidence right there? That's a scene that takes place that he's not in. It's not something he knows about. So isn't that evidence right there that the film is saying he's really time traveling?
Except you could also argue that somebody who is having these kinds of fantasies when they're insane are imagining all of it. Because I always think back to A Beautiful Mind, when there's all kinds of action scenes, sometimes, not often in that movie, but there's one big action scene, especially I think early on. And Ron Howard talks on the commentary about how could he be doing this? People question Russell Crowe's character. How is he doing all these things if he's not really doing these things? Well, he's maybe just sitting in a phone booth somewhere, or sitting against a wall, imagining all of it. So maybe James Cole is doing the same thing. But that's what fascinates me about this movie. I think the story actually holds up very well because it does fuck with you. And I'm kind of glad it does fuck with me as much as it does. If it answered all those questions, I wouldn't find it so fascinating now. But I guess you're bothered by that. You would rather it be more clear, even though you and I have agreed
that I actually don't think it's that ambiguous. I think he's a time traveler. We talked about Inception. Inception, it really does plant the seed and make you wonder if it's all a dream and it's reasonable to believe. But I think there's enough evidence that he truly is time traveling. Would that drive him mad? Yeah, of course. But then they even warn him at the very beginning of the film when they select him to do it. People don't come back, or when they come back, they're not the same. Time travel has a lot of side effects, and one of them is madness. It makes you crazy. So that's just how I interpreted that part. And that's not the part that bugs me. You know, I like ambiguity in a story. I don't need the film to draw it all out for me and paint a pretty little picture. When I say I have a problem with the narrative, I think it's more that I don't think that Terry Gilliam has a really firm grasp on pacing and emotional buildup and release. I don't feel very emotionally invested in the characters. I don't buy the relationship between him and Catherine whatsoever. Yeah. They have zero chemistry, so much so that when they get together at the end, I'm like, is this really happening? Because it doesn't make any sense that they would hook up as a couple. Like, there was no buildup. I just didn't buy any of it. Another problem with all that might be just Madeline Stowe, a very lovely woman.
Oh, she's so beautiful.
True beauty. Maybe not the world's greatest actress. Certainly not in this movie. Whatever she had to pull off, she just comes across like reading lines, exposition. I just don't feel it from her whatsoever. And she could have the greatest arc in the film. The most interesting version of the story could be the story told from her perspective, where she's a shrink trying to determine whether this man is insane or a time traveler, and then overcoming her skepticism and believing him and trying to save the world.
She does do that, though.
She does do that, but she doesn't pull it off as an actress, is my point. She's just this character who seems more like she's along for the ride.
If you think she's an F in this movie, if you graded her, I would say it's more like a C minus. I don't
sure,
think it's as
yeah,
bad as that.
An F would be too mean, but yeah, a C. It's just not good enough.
Well, you're not saying C, I'm saying C. You're saying more like a D, D minus. The bigger problem in this is not her fault. I guess they make it work because she talks with one of her fellow shrinks, Frank Gorshin, the Riddler, who plays her boss. She says something about, I want to help that poor man. Oh, that poor man. And she also does believe in the Cassandra complex thing. She is lecturing about that when David Morse is there in the audience and hears it. And talk about weirdo actor. Not usually. David Morse is actually one of those actors who's just rock solid. Look at him in The Green Mile 4 years later. Talk about rock solid sidekick. But in this movie, he's a weirdo. Christopher Plummer with his Foghorn Leghorn accent. Really laying on thick. A Canadian actor, but sounds like from the deep south. We'll talk about Brad Pitt in a second. I think Bruce Willis is excellent. One of the best things he's ever done. But getting back to Stowe, not so much her performance, but the way it's written. Okay, I want to help that poor man. Fine, I get that. But why does she not bail when he gets out of the car and he sees the pictures of the 12 monkeys? She goes to reach for the door handle to pull it closed and doesn't do it. Now, you could argue because she said before, I want to help him. And she still does. And maybe, well, she must be at that point starting to feel like maybe he's actually telling the truth.
He kidnapped her. But she should run for her life.
And also she doesn't scream in the hotel room. It's one thing to tie her down so she can't go anywhere. But it's another thing for her not to scream for help because she could easily do that. He didn't gag her mouth. And that's Gilliam's fault or even David Peoples who wrote this. Now, Peoples wrote three legendary screenplays. Adapted Blade Runner, Unforgiven, and then this. He did other things, I'm sure, but he did those three screenplays alone. That's a career for anybody. Yeah. And his wife, Janet, wrote with him on this. The only screenplay she ever wrote. I always thought she wrote other things with him, including some of those. But no, it's just this. The only thing she ever wrote with him. So maybe it's their fault that it doesn't really fully work with the Madeline Stowe thing about why she doesn't bail on James, except Chris and I talk about this all the time. You and I have talked about this plenty of times. She stays with him because the movie has to happen. Because if she closes that door and drives away, the movie's over.
Okay, but if you make a cheap decision like that, it's going to make me less invested.
I'm giving you that. I'm guaranteeing you that.
And it's not even just that. The plot jumps around so much. It feels strange to me that they didn't make a decision to have some kind of narrative device to illustrate time travel. Because he jumps around from scene to scene. And instead of showing us, they tell us. So he's always saying out loud, this is 1990. I'm supposed to be in 1996. When it feels like they could have found a much more elegant way to convey this information, you're shaking your head.
Two reasons why. One is budget.
Fair.
Although we see him go through time traveling once, but that's probably all they could really afford to do, I guess you could argue. The bigger thing is I think Gilliam wants to make you not really fully believe that this ever happened, that he ever time traveled. Because if they show it, they do. But if they show it multiple times, then it more likely has to be real.
So how did he get that bullet wound?
I know. There are a lot of things that do tear this down. You're right. It's probably a time travel movie. But the fact that I'm not fully sure about it, it's like Taxi Driver. We've talked about that. And Vertigo. Your theory on Vertigo is that Jimmy Stewart's character goes in the mental hospital a little past the halfway point of the movie. And from that point on, everything else is him imagining it. Taxi Driver does the shootout. All that was real. But then he just bleeds to death and dies. And the whole thing at the end, which I think has to be not real, even though I don't think Scorsese and Paul Schrader agree with me on that, but that's fine. That's their opinion. I have my own. But the very end of that movie, the last maybe 5 minutes, can't possibly be real. We talked about 2001 earlier in this podcast. That's a movie open for a lot of interpretation. And the best sci-fi movies, I think, are. But I'll grant you that Stowe's not the greatest thing in this movie. She hasn't acted that much in her whole career. She hasn't made a big screen movie since 2003. Now, she was pretty good in We Were Soldiers in 2002. I love that movie. One of the more underrated war films. I know Mel Gibson's in it, and he's tainted, and that's true. But it's an excellent war movie. Also, Shortcuts before this, and then Unlawful Entry. Some good titles in her resume. But the best performance in this? No. I think Willis is really good. We'll get back to him. We got to talk about Brad Pitt. It's been all this time. No Brad Pitt mentions. Every time I saw this movie, the first four or five times, whatever it was, I always thought, how do you not win the Oscar for this movie this year? Because he also, of course, is a lead in Seven. So it's kind of like the Sean Penn thing in 2003. He wins for Mystic River. He was also really good in 21 Grams in 2003. So he got two great performances, but he can only win for one movie. So in a way, that helped him by being good in something else. Pitt's been good for a few years in different kinds of movies. And now it's a culmination in this film. Wacky performance, so different than anything he'd ever done before. But now seeing it this time, I still like it. But I don't love it as much as I did before because he lays it on, as does Plummer, as does Morse in different ways, very, very thick.
I was watching this thing about how he found a shrink who worked with bipolar patients and trained with him to learn how to get all the manic mannerisms down. I can't say I know bipolar people. Actually, that's not true. I do know a bipolar person. He's nothing like this. I've never seen him behave with the tics and the everything. it's all turned up to 11, which is fine. That's also Terry Gilliam's style. And yeah. I think the whole movie, that's the tone. Everything's turned up to 11. I mean, look at the future scenes. You want to make an argument for everything being
psychiatrists
in
are nuts.
His head. Nuts,
but the various people, the biologist and the botanist, they seem like they're nuts.
Just look at what the future looks like. That doesn't make any sense. It looks like a fantasy. The set design, the giant globe with all the televisions, the hamster wheel that runs. It seems like a fantasy, whereas in 1996, feels pretty grounded in reality. Mm-hmm. So that's almost like a better argument for your theory.
Also in the madhouse, it's not just Brad Pitt who's way over the top.
Every single person in there is... There's somebody dancing with themselves. There's somebody
almost like somebody would imagine an asylum to be, that everybody's doing that rather than maybe one or two, but not all of them.
We covered One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
I was just thinking about that.
And that's probably a movie that is exaggerating what being in a mental institution would be like, and that everybody's doing something weird all the time.
No,
it's like much, much muted compared to...
The main characters in that are fairly normal people. They just have a lot of issues and they feel like they have to commit themselves. The ones who've committed themselves... As Nicholson says to them, you could just walk around the street. What's wrong with you? You're no different than any average asshole walking around out there.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's right about that.
Yeah,
they're pretty normal.
Isn't obvious. This is the style of the film. Like, yeah. I forgive that. I agree with you that all the praise for Brad Pitt's performance, it should have been a comedy. How great would this movie have been if it was a comedy? Imagine how funny.
Monty Python guy.
Terry Gilliam is hysterical. He wrote one of my favorite comedies of all time, Life of Brian. He directed Monty Python and the Holy Grail. He can do it. And Brad Pitt, we know, can be hysterically funny. Bruce Willis started in comedy. I think he's a great comic actor. You have all the pieces, and you could have taken this performance and made it hysterical, and it has its funny moments. It's probably some of the lightest stuff in the movie. All the ticks. It's a lot. I think part of the reason that he got so much positive attention for the performance was because when they cast him in the film, he was practically a nobody. He was that guy from Thelma and Louise. Between casting him in the film and the film getting released, he released Interview with a Vampire.
Legends of the Fall.
Legends of the Fall, thank you. Is there something else I'm forgetting? There is.
Well, Seven, but he's not a pretty boy in that, but he's still a leading man kind of character.
He's a very serious actor and a romantic lead in two to three of those films. And for him to turn around and go from this pretty
so
boy
different.
Career, which was only such a trajectory, mm-hmm. too, and everybody had these great expectations for him, and then he comes out with this movie where he is doing the complete opposite. It could almost seem like a bit of career sabotage.
Yeah.
Not that that would ruin his career, but that he had this trajectory of being a leading man, and then he does this totally out there wacky performance, which I think, as we know Brad Pitt now, he's more drawn to performances like this.
But we didn't know
that
weird... then.
No, we didn't know
that
then.
And a lot of people would have kept on doing the pretty boy thing, because he did them before. California, no, in 93, that's not a pretty boy rule, but Thelma and Louise is... I'm not criticizing his work in these movies, but he is such a beautiful man, and you can call him a pretty boy as a result. You just said the two films in 94, Vampire and Legends, pretty boy kinds of roles, even though I think he's pretty good in both films. He didn't want to do Vampire. We talked about that last fall. But then the very next year after that, and you say he got cast long before, so maybe it was just dumb luck, but he does movies where he looks like, for Brad Pitt, absolute dog shit. Most of Seven, or at least half of Seven, he's beat up from getting hammered by Spacey in the face with a gun, has a broken arm. They work into the script because he actually broke his arm on set when they were doing one of the stunts. And then in this, where he never looks Brad Pitt pretty. That very famous shot where he sees Cole at his house when he's supposed to just be Jeffrey Goines, normal guy, with his father giving a lecture, this big expensive dinner. Turns to the camera, monkeys. And that great look, the crazy eye as well. I don't know if they had some kind of fake eye or if Pitt can just do that with his eyes. Some actors can.
Yeah, he's like opening one eye more than the other, which is another great example of his level of overkill. Now that we can look back at his career as it is now, which is just such an incredible career with so many diverse performances, we can look back at this and say, well, he was just a young actor full of vim and vigor who was maybe overdoing it in a part with a director who was indulging him. And there's probably lots of people listening to this right now who are like, what are they talking about? That performance is perfect. I wouldn't change a thing. I want him to be over the top. But it's maybe it's our taste as we're getting older, too, or we're like, ugh, it's a little much. Or maybe it's 2020 eyes, too. 1996 was a different time for film.
You hit on it just around 95.
95, sorry.
But in a way, it was 96, because it really was out in 96 more, but it got released in 95. You just hit on it. I love that line at the end Bruce Willis has after they've watched the Hitchcock marathon all day long, including Vertigo, of course. This movie homages Vertigo. One big way with that is that it's Madeline Stowe, who says she's Judy when they get tickets and everything trying to go to the Florida Keys. But Kim Novak is playing Judy Barton, I believe is her name. But Judy's her first name. The actress who plays Madeline. Isn't that fun? So Madeline plays Judy, and Judy plays Madeline, except it's Kim Novak. So it's
that's great.
Bit of a divergent there.
Yeah, that's really cool.
But anyway, when he talks about the movies, it's such a great line. I'm not so sure that this guy would think it, but I love it anyway. The movie never changes. Every time you see it, it seems different because you're different. And
there
maybe that's the problem.
Is.
If we had done 12 Monkeys 10 years ago or 20 years ago, I might be saying, you're crazy. Brad Pitt's perfect. How did he not win the Oscar that year? Although I think really, especially in retrospect, Ed Harris should have won for Apollo 13, like we said a few months ago. And I thought for the longest time it should have been Pitt. Then it started becoming Harris. Now it's really Harris for me. But I bet that's part of it. I'm 46 and you're 42. And I bet we feel differently about movies and performances than we did even 10 years ago when we first met, or whenever we met. I guess it's about 10 years ago now.
Yeah, I'm not embarrassed of my opinion from back then. But it is true. I feel that way about a lot of movies I've watched. Movies that I loved back when I was young, when I was a teenager or in my early 20s. I just don't love anymore.
I don't think we'll ever re-review the movies we did when we first started doing this project in the early part of 2013, March, April, May. But if we did do the Chaplin films, the other silent films, and then when we got into the 30s when it was Marx Brothers were around that time and some of the Jimmy Stewart movies around then, what would we think of them now? Would I like them the same way? Would I like them less or more? Would you like them less or more?
Yeah, we've spent the last 7.5 years analyzing movies and thinking analytically about movies. I know more about movies and I think I have more insight into them at this stage in the podcast than I did when we first started. For the reason we decided to do the films chronologically when we did the AFI movies was, of course, for the history of understanding them and how they affected one another, but also because we knew that those really old movies weren't going to get as many hits and we wanted to warm up on them. And we knew we would get better as we went along. And so we didn't want to do The Godfather when we were just getting started.
I don't want to watch Birth of a Nation again. That was about a 20-minute podcast. We'd spend 20 minutes just on the racism if we did that movie again, let alone the rest of the story itself and the influence of that film, because it is influential and it is a movie that belongs on that list for a lot of reasons. But holy shit, the racism. Wow.
This is an interesting conversation to have when we're talking about 12 Monkeys, because one of the themes in 12 Monkeys is the fallibility of memory. Cole doesn't trust himself, and each time he recalls that shooting in the airport,
it changes.
It's slightly different. Yeah, they shot at different times and they used a different take for each time he recalls that memory.
At one point is Brad Pitt running with the case, and then later, of course, it's David Morse.
I was like, oh, right. I swore it was Brad Pitt at the beginning, and I'm like, did I imagine that? And I couldn't find the clip.
That's
on
the
YouTube.
Point.
Anybody who's honest with themselves knows that that's exactly how memories behave. Anybody who grew up with a sibling and has tried to recall childhood memories with their sibling can tell you. You will have two dramatically things, and you are both equally sure that that's exactly how it went down. And then, of course, everybody in the movie in 2035 remembers the pandemic being caused by the Army of the 12 Monkeys, but that was false. It was a misunderstanding that ended up being codified into gospel, and you can never really know the truth. And in the same way, time is a river. You never put your foot in the same river twice. If we watched Birth of a Nation again, it just simply wouldn't be the same movie to us.
I like that Cole says repeatedly that he was picked because he remembers things. And yet in his own memories of his dreams, he's not remembering it accurately because it does change. I don't think he sees any one face with the red hair, the yellow coat, and the case running through the airport the first time. But then it is Pitt, and then it's Morse.
They pick him because he remembers things, but then when he tells them what he sees and what he experiences, they seem to doubt him and give him a hard time. Those interrogation scenes are pretty cruel and bullying. And he says, you sent me to 1990. And they're like, well, you failed. They failed. They sent him.
And they sent him naked. So what's he supposed to do? He's got to find clothes. And that's why he's wearing a woman's raincoat. It's all he has on when he's drilling there. Now, okay, we haven't really talked about Bruce Willis yet. We just talked about Pitt and we talked about Stowe. I just said a few minutes ago, I think it's Bruce Willis's, if not best work, it's certainly the top 3 or 5. I guess Die Hard may be the best work he's ever done, or we could just go through the whole catalog, I guess, and find 4 or 5 great performances. For all this guy's faults, especially in the last 10 or 15 years, where he's really just alienated everybody in Hollywood, it seems. And I don't know how people in Hollywood feel about him. Being a Republican doesn't help, I'm sure. He'd probably say that's what it is. But he seems like he's also an asshole. Chris and I just covered him recently on The Last Boy Scout, which I liked, and Chris seemed to like too, and we think he's pretty good in the film. That was peak Bruce Willis 1991. This is 4 years later, and one of the mandates that Terry Gilliam had was, I don't want to see the steely glare, that I'm too cool for school kind of thing, which he absolutely is, even though I liked it, in The Last Boy Scout. Obviously Die Hard to a huge degree, although he's so human. Gilliam gave him the role based on a scene in Die Hard. Apparently, when he's picking the glass of his feet and crying about, I wish I had told my wife I love her and all, I wish I had one more chance to see her, because he doesn't think he's going to see her again. He thinks he's going to die in this whole incident. And of course, we all know Die Hard. He ends up saving the day. That movie worked for a lot of reasons. Bruce Willis was a huge one, though, because he was so human. Maybe somebody being fairly new to us. Yeah, he was on TV and moonlighting, but nobody really thought of a TV actor that could do a movie and be a star. Well, Bruce Willis is one of the people that changed that attitude. If this isn't his best work, it's certainly up there. And I'd say there are a few reasons why I say that. One is when he is in the asylum and they're all interviewing him and he wants to go up and draw a picture. So he starts walking up and the two guards collapse on him. I'm not going to hurt anyone. The line delivery on that, I think, is so awesome, because it could be threatening. It could be whiny. It just seems like he's being reasonable. He's more reasonable than anybody else in that whole room. I just want to show these people this drawing. I think it's the 12 monkeys drawing. I'm not going to hurt any of you. When he is back in the quote-unquote future later on, when he's got the rabbit blanket thing and they're singing to him, I found my thrill, which of course he had heard, and how would they know that? But he'd heard that song when he was back with Madeline Stowe in the past. And then he starts laughing, I'm just insane. But in the middle of the laugh, it turns into a cry. That's a great moment. When he's drooling in that translucent raincoat when he first gets to the quote-unquote past in 1990, Bruce Willis looks like awful dog shit in the whole movie, really, but especially that scene. For a movie star to do that is so cool. Apparently, Gilliam wanted Jeff Bridges and Nick Nolte to play these two roles. I assume he wanted Bridges to play Cole and Nolte to play Goines. And they would have been good. They're great actors. But I think he got lucky in casting the bigger stars. I think they were forced on him by Universal. Because I think Willis is doing some excellent stuff here. And I'm not so sure, as much as I love Bridges, he would have been as good. But what do you think about Willis? We've covered him so many times now in different kinds of movies. Die Hard, Pulp Fiction, Sixth Sense. Sin City we did as well, you and I did. But what about this one?
I agree with you. It's a shame that he seems to have destroyed his reputation in Hollywood. He's one of the great leading men of his generation. He has charisma to spare. And part of his charisma is that he can express vulnerability. That's really what turned him into a star with Die Hard and why that movie works so well. And he totally shows it here. You didn't talk about the scene when he's kidnapped Madeline Stowe and she's driving and he's in the back seat mm-hmm. and he is just rambling crazy. I feel like it's a little bit overkill, but the movie's supposed to be overkill. And I probably should have mentioned part of my whole problem with the movie is that Terry Gilliam is just not my cup of tea. I don't really like...
Not a Brazil person, right?
I hate Brazil. But I love The Fisher King. But that's probably one of his very most accessible films.
True.
I read this great interview with Ryan Murphy. He was complaining about how everybody loves the O.J. Simpson series, the American Justice mm-hmm. O.J. Simpson. I loved that miniseries. I just thought it was wonderful. I think I told you 100 times how great it was. And he was like, I hate that that's everybody's favorite Ryan Murphy show, because it's the one where he gave in to the studio and he tamped it down and he took his personality away and he just gave them what they wanted. And he's so good at what he does that he made this incredible TV show, but he feels like it's the least expressive of his vision. And then I wonder if Terry Gilliam, an insult to him that my favorite Terry Gilliam film is the least Terry Gilliam-y. Anyways, my point was going to be that in the car, in the backseat of the car, tremendous vulnerability. He really doesn't seem afraid to embarrass himself. Some actors just can't go there because they don't want to look silly, but he's okay with being foolish if that's what the part calls for.
And incredibly vulnerable. And also when he hears, maybe it's Blueberry Hill, but whatever it is, the way his face crumples in that great, oh, this music of the 20th century, I love it so much. Putting his head out of the car like a dog as well is a bit of a nice touch because he loves the air so much. This is a guy who's never been nominated for an Oscar. I'm not sure what the role would have been that he should have been nominated for. He's one of those guys that probably should win, and he probably never will because it seems like he's hated in the business now. But he probably should win some kind of lifetime achievement thing because he's had such an incredible career. And it's too bad that for about 20 years, or definitely about 15, he's made very little that anyone cares about. Looper was really good. And we talked about
another
this.
Another time travel movie where he meets himself.
And dies, because Chris and I talked about in The Last Boy Scout. He doesn't die in that movie. And of course, he doesn't die in any of the Die Hards, of course, ironically. But he has died a lot for a big star, including in this. Died in Looper, he dies in The Sixth Sense, dies in Armageddon. I won't keep going because those movies I think are well enough known that that's not really spoilers, but they're enough if I keep going, there'll be spoilers. But for a big star, he dies a lot. And I think I've talked about this more than once about how when he was on Inside the Actor's Studio, James Lipton said, you died in whatever it was, Armageddon or Sixth Sense. That's rare for you. That's unusual. No, it's not. He dies a lot. He dies more than almost anybody else I can think of, especially for the big stars. We all know Terry Gilliam is known for comedy with the Monty Python stuff especially. In Brazil, in 85, 10 years before this, with Universal, which was such a controversial situation. I'm not a huge fan of that movie, so I really don't know the details of that, but I know he had real problems. And working with Universal again was a surprise to some people because of the problems he had with them on that film. But that's also a comedy. It is interesting that a guy who was known for that, though, pretty straightforward but surreal comedy, but Life of Brian and Holy Grail and the TV series they did, Meaning of Life, which I've only ever seen once, but those movies are not the kind of film where you scratch your head and say, what really happened? So I kind of like, in a way, that he didn't just get pigeonholed in that way. He went off into something altogether different with this and with Brazil. And some of Fisher King is also pretty surreal. His more recent stuff, which didn't really work. I've seen everything he's ever made, but I can't really tell you that much about it. Then again, the documentary by Fulton and Pepe, or the hell their names are, the guys who made Lost in La Mancha. Excellent making of documentary about a failed film, which finally got made with Adam Driver just last year, and it's okay. The documentary is way better than the movie that he finally got to make almost 20 years later, which should have been Johnny Depp and Rochefort, I think is the guy who should have played Don Quixote.
And I was thinking about that film because that documentary is just really about the streak of bad luck that took that film down. They actually had their own share of bad luck making 12 Monkeys. They had weather problems. Terry Gilliam fell off a horse and almost died. I think he was lucky that he was okay, but I think it delayed production.
Was he just on the horse for his own edification?
Just for fun, I guess. Okay. Yeah.
There are no horses in this movie that I'm aware of. Apparently the tagline was supposed to be, the future's in the hands of a man who has none. And then people in marketing thought, but that sounds like he has no hands. It's a good tagline if you just add this one little bit. The future's in the hands of a man who has no future.
Yeah, but the tagline they went with is just superior in every way. The future is history. Come on.
That's good,
you
too.
You don't outdo that. That's like a perfect masterpiece of
also
a tagline.
Also a loop. It's a time
exactly.
loop. Yeah, that's good. Most of the movie is set in the grimy parts of Philadelphia, which obviously reminds us of the early and now the more recent Rocky and Creed flicks because of Stallone playing a character who's just barely getting by in the shitty parts of Philadelphia. And of course, it's a virus movie like Contagion, which we covered a few months ago. So it's very timely this year. I didn't pick it for that reason. I wanted to cover this movie before we even got into this year. We didn't know about the virus back then. But it is prescient. Both movies, actually, are pretty prescient in a lot of ways because coronavirus hasn't been as bad as 12 Monkeys or Contagion, obviously, so far. But it won't shock me if somebody finds this podcast a year or 5 or 10 years from now and they are living underground like in 12 Monkeys, or they are getting by like in Contagion where millions have died and they have to wear a bracelet to be identified as somebody who is safe to walk around. I don't have faith that this isn't going to go a lot worse than it has, especially the way that even we have handled it, but certainly the Americans have handled it. So I'm not saying a movie predicts the future because it hasn't gone as bad as that. This virus messes people up and they're dead. It seems to be, it's almost like Ebola where you get it and you are dead. I'll do the what happens next. Even though the future lady who's in insurance, love the way she says that too, will probably stop Dr. Peters, so that's David Morris's character, Dr. Peters, from spreading the virus even further, but he's already unleashed it in Philadelphia. The security guard at the
TSA guy.
Yeah, he made him open it. Just like in the new Apes movies, the very first one, where the guy gets sneezed on and then he's going to travel around. And that's the suggestion in the Apes films as to why humanity died off the way it did. It may not be as thorough as it was in the original timeline where Dr. Peters obviously went to all these places in Asia and Europe and Africa and South America and whatnot, went around the world to make it go faster.
But they released it in an airport.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty significant. If the disease is going to spread from a TSA guy, it's going to go all over the world in a heartbeat. He doesn't need to release it.
So she's probably going to stop him from going any further, but it may be too late anyway.
They also imply that they're not really trying to stop the virus. They keep saying it already happened. We cannot undo this damage. What they're trying to do is get a sample of the virus so that in the future they can find a vaccine or a cure.
Yeah, arguably, but he also could say that she has gone into the past. And Jose as well, because yes, he's supposed to follow orders, he being James Cole. This is all about following orders now, isn't it? They're not watching what he's doing, and they're not saying that. Maybe they are seeing it somehow, and they're not telling him what they're seeing, because they do have that weird TV ball in the past. Anyway, when she says the line, I'm in insurance, that could be a multiple meaning line. It obviously could just be, she's going to try to prevent him from doing this, which is what I think it's supposed to be. Getting a sample would be valuable as well. But I just said it. I don't think it's really going to matter, because the virus is out there. And look at what's happened in reality, where America could have been better off than they are right now if they had just done a better job of trying to tamp down COVID. And they didn't do that. And it feels to me like they're just biding their time until it gets a lot worse when we get into proper cold and flu season. Or what happens next is Cole's just having an insane hallucination and he can look forward to medication time. Medication time, gentlemen. Medication time. Cuckoo's Nest reference again.
We keep bringing up the floating ball of televisions, which ended up costing the production a lot more than they anticipated.
Didn't want to work properly.
No, because they ripped it off completely from a famous architect. The whole notion of the chair that raises and a ball of TVs was ripped off directly from artwork of his or design of his.
Who's the guy?
Well, I sure wish I wrote it down, Ryan.
I'll look it up later on. I'll put it on the website. Okay. Little addition.
They had to give him a large sum of money. He was furious about it when he saw the film. He wanted them to pull it, and instead they gave him a lot of money. And Gilliam got raked over the coals for going way over budget on The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, which then bombed and could have destroyed his career, so he was really meticulous about staying on budget. So I'm sure he wasn't happy about that development. But credit the artists that you're copying when you're making a big-budget Hollywood film.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things about that Lost in La Mancha documentary those guys did, because they did the hamster factor for this one, they showed that for a guy who was so established in the business, not a Hollywood director, as he would say in that at the end, because he goes on Letterman, and Letterman's intro is a Hollywood director who's directed Brazil and whatever else. Here's Terry Gilliam with 12 Monkeys. And as he hears that, he says to his assistant or something, Hollywood director, I'm not a Hollywood director. Okay, you're not, but you also are at the same point.
Yeah, you are. What do you want?
I think Terry Gilliam is an interesting guy, as all hell, so artistic, very smart, but also pretty irresponsible. You look at someone like Clint Eastwood, for all of his faults, his movies come in on time, often under budget and often under time. That's a big thing. And if you're going to be a Scorsese, and I think he's gone over budget, I'm sure, plenty of times, but look at the output. And Gilliam hasn't really had the same output, so that's probably one reason why he hasn't gotten the same sort of response. I said earlier about how this movie succeeded, so how is he not getting a bigger budget? Well, I didn't look it up, but I'm guessing Fear and Loathing got a pretty good budget, and then that bombs, and then finally they could say, well, nothing for you anymore.
Did you say earlier that Fear and Loathing steam is raising over the years?
I think it has for a long time. I know a lot of people that bring that up as one of their favorite of his
really?
Films.
Really? Wow. Yeah?
My old roommate sure did. He was a big fan. I saw it because he owned it. I think I'd seen it before, but I saw it again and thought, I just don't get it. I'm not a drug guy. I've done pot since then, edibles, and I didn't have anything close to that experience. So I don't know. I just can't relate to it. Didn't really like it that much. I think Depp chewing on a cigar the whole time, or the hell that cigarette thing he's chewing on, doesn't help his performance at all.
I have no desire to ever watch it again.
One of the themes going on here, too, though, is the 7 golden vials, and that is what Dr. Peters has in that case. That's apparently supposed to be a thing from the Bible, 7 golden vials filled with God's wrath. And this should not be overlooked, but James Cole's initials are J.C.
Oh, yeah.
And he also dies, according to the internet, on Friday the 13th, which, forget the horror movies, is just supposed to be an unlucky day. And then also, the opening of the movie, the text does say 5 billion people died in 1997. But that's according to James Cole, who is in an asylum institution at the time. So it also could be more of his hallucinations. We've talked about that making of documentary on this DVD, and those same directors went on to do Lost in La Mancha. They called their documentary on the making of 12 Monkeys the Hamster Factor. And that's because in the scene where Bruce Willis is being cleaned and washed and all that kind of stuff, he's naked in this movie quite a few times. You don't ever see him full frontal, but he's from behind naked multiple times.
That's why I give this film at least a partial pass.
There you go. Hang on. Also in 1995, he's got a great ass!
He does have a pretty great ass.
And Brad Pitt's got his head all up in it! But those guys called their making of the Hamster Factor because in the scene where Bruce Willis is putting a needle in his arm, there is a very small off-to-the-side shot. Not small, it's a wide shot, but a little hamster in a wheel, and the hamster wouldn't run, and Gilliam apparently spent, I think, a day on that shot, and that's one of the reasons why, again, people that make movies, the studios and producers, will say, this isn't that important. And I actually counted, because we rewound, and I said, how many seconds of film is this? It's 4. It's for 4 seconds. But why would that matter so much to him that he would insist on getting that hamster to run the wheel that it wasn't doing? I'm not exactly sure if this holds up, but it also plays in the notion that he is this hamster in a wheel. I guess we all are hamsters in wheels, aren't we? But that's why he wanted the hamster to run. And you can barely even notice it. You have to be looking for it in that shot. You're looking
like
at
there's a close-up ever.
The star of the movie, naked. Well, you can't see his dong, but putting a needle in his arm. You're looking at that, not the rat.
When 1995, hamster, whatever. Bruce Willis is naked, I'm not looking at the hamster, guys.
But is this supposed to be that maybe in some ways he's saying, this is what really matters, that they're making this guy go through this wheel, whoever they are, whether it's a future thing or a real thing in the 1990, 1996 timelines.
the story certainly makes me grateful for modern day digital technology that completely negates that whole problem, where you could just leave a bee crew waiting for the hamster to behave themselves or create the whole thing digitally.
They would do digitally.
And composite it. I'm sure there's plenty of stock footage of hamsters running on wheels and you could just throw it in there, no problem. They probably wouldn't even bother having a hamster on set in the first place and trying to get it there on set.
Yeah, they wouldn't need to. Later on, we find out Jeffrey talks to him about planting the seeds of genocide because he had said maybe the human race doesn't deserve to live, because they show that scene of the monkey dying, the monkey scene, in a cage. It's been poisoned. That's real footage. And that's when James says something like that. Maybe we all deserve to die if we're going to do this to creatures. Because the movie is an animal-loving kind of film. In the quote-unquote future, when he's out there in this spacesuit type thing with his whole condom suit on underneath that, you see bears and lions and spiders and all kinds of animals that are just owning the earth. In the winter as well, when it's not really the time of year for all them to be doing that. So when it was summer, if he had gone up there in July, he would have seen a hell of a lot more animals that were out and about reclaiming the earth. This is definitely a movie you could argue is for vegetarianism.
Another 2020 lens thing to put this movie through is they're right. Humans actually are destroying the world. Now in 2020, we can say, oh, the evidence is all around us and we're reaching the point of no return, where even if all of humanity died tomorrow, there's not actually a guarantee that we could reverse the damage that we had done. But it would certainly be a good start if 5 billion people disappeared from the world. I'm not advocating, I'm not being Thanos over here, but you could say that there's a part of him that's correct. Mm-hmm. This is actually something that nature needs to happen, is to massively thin the herd.
Yeah, humans are not helping this planet. And it's not any one person's fault, but it's the way that especially the West lives.
It seems less crazy now. He's not Chicken Little. You know, they talk about that. David Morse's character, he is Cassandra screaming to everybody the truth and nobody believes him. It's his curse. But as most environmental scientists have been for my life, we've watched them try to warn the world about what's going on.
And we're just not listening.
Rather than make some difficult but relatively small changes in the grand scheme of things, we would rather burn it all down because we're too lazy and selfish and craven to fix the problem.
And the rich people, of course, want to make every bit of money they can, and they don't want to make the huge changes that they would need to make in their companies. Well, the Cassandra complex is agony of foreknowledge, but you're impotent to do anything about it. So you said that Dr. Peter says that, the David Morse character, but also, of course, our main character, James Cole, has that. He thinks anyway, but then he has the opportunity to change the future, so should he? And I guess he does, and so does Catherine. But the irony is, when they're going to Florida, is they're just going to run away. They don't want to be in one of the bigger cities like Philadelphia when this goes bad, if it goes bad. Plus, they're running away from him being wanted for murder of those two potential rapists. And it's not that scene, I don't think. It's actually, I think, when he's beating up the pimp. Crazy fucking dentist! As he ripped his own teeth out. I like the way that guy reads that line. But I think it's when he's beating on the pimp, when he's in the middle of doing it, and he looks back at Madeline Stowe. That could have been flat out hilarious. I chuckled at that, though, because he just keeps punching. He doesn't even need to look at the guy when he's slugging him. That was kind of funny. So he and Catherine have changed the future, possibly. They're not really sure about that, but at the very least, they're just getting out of Dodge. So if he hadn't pulled the gun and tried to kill Dr. Peters, then they would have probably gotten away and been okay because they had the fake passports, they've disguised themselves. But I'm going to bring this back to what I've said about this whole COVID situation for a while now, and I'm going to sound like a savage, like I know I have a few other times in this podcast, but it's what I've been saying for months about the coronavirus. If we could somehow, with the DeLorean, find the first person who had this virus and just kill him or her and burn them right then and there and it goes to no one else, don't you fucking do that. It's the old do you kill baby Hitler argument. Yes, you do. If you could be sure. And we are sure because, well, okay, I'm going to say now the movie is a time travel movie for this argument. If we could go back to, I guess it would have been late last year, I guess it would have been in China, but wherever it was, kill that person right then and there and make sure that they don't spread this to anybody else. And if I'm taken in for murder and I go to jail and I knew that I saved, at this point, hundreds of thousands of lives and what might still be millions of lives, okay, yeah. Fine.
It's been hundreds of thousands of lives now, but it's going to be millions of lives. There's no doubt about it. And it's also going to be a scourge that we're probably going to be dealing with maybe forever. You know, there was a patient zero for smallpox too, and that ravaged humans on and off for centuries, many, many generations. COVID could be the same thing.
One thing about the time travel that I do also think makes it a question about whether or not it's legit is that every time he's really trapped in a no-win situation, that's when he just disappears. When he's bound up in the insane asylum and somehow disappears. the security guards, the cops, whatever, from Dr. Goins' party are converging on him and he's splashing in the water. Another thing that convinces Catherine that he's time traveling because she knows she just heard him. She looks around a second later and he's not there anymore. But he disappears at the most convenient times. Now, you could argue that it's a time travel movie and they just timed it right. But how is it that they know to time travel him out of there at those times when he cannot possibly get out of those situations?
Like you said earlier, for the movie to happen.
Super easy. Barely an inconvenience. Yeah, in the end, all the Army of the 12 Monkeys have done is released animals from a zoo and they've left Dr. Goins in a cage. They're just pranksters. And because everyone thought it was the Army of the 12 Monkeys because of all the insignias and the logos and the graffiti everywhere.
Said, we did it.
Right. And they did in their stupid little prank. Not that stupid, I guess. It's a pretty significant thing that they let giraffes and monkeys and
they probably thought it was
going to
be the biggest bit of news to ever happen in Philadelphia
that day
year.
It was.
They didn't know.
It reminds me of a small and nice touch in I Am Legend, the Will Smith movie, when he's scrounging for food and he goes into people's apartments and houses and you see Christmas decorations everywhere. Because Christmas had happened when that virus took over and killed everybody off. And if people far into the future want to look back at this, because of course he knows what happened, he's a doctor as well, and this is pretty recent, it's only been a few years for him. But let's say 40 years, 50 years in the future, they go back and see all these Christmas decorations. Well, it must have been some kind of Christmas bandit or some kind of evil Christmas thing. But no, it just happened to be Christmas when that happened. And it just happened to be that the 12 Monkeys people did their thing, nothing to do with the virus, at the exact same time.
Much like if you fast forward another couple hundred years and archaeologists are going back and looking at this, they would say, back in the 1990s, people kept trees decorated in their houses all year round. They would believe that that was just the way people decorated and not understand that it had anything to do with a holiday.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I am actually surprised I never watched the series, which was just called 12 Monkeys, on Sci-Fi, starring Aaron Stanford. He's Pyro in the X-Men movies in the 2000s. That ran for 4 seasons, and I never watched any of it. I probably should have. He is playing James Cole, but I didn't see too many other actors that... Well, I guess the Goins character was reprised, but I didn't see too many other names that were reprised. I'm guessing it's the same storyline. I don't know why I didn't watch it, because I love this movie so much, but I didn't. I assume you didn't either.
I didn't even know it existed until I was doing my research for this movie.
And we already said that Nolte and... Oh, here it is. No, my notes have Nolte as Cole and Bridges as Goins, so there you go. And it didn't seem like Gilliam and Willis are the most obvious combination, but Willis took very little money for this movie. He just wanted to work with Gilliam, which was true about Robin Williams. When they asked him why he did Fisher King, he wanted to work with Gilliam as much as anything else. But he's just not being Bruce Willis, and I really appreciate that. Sometimes it's the wrong thing to cast a big star in a role and not let him be the big star, and sometimes it's the exact right thing to do. And I think in this case, that was the exact right thing to do. And yes, he did 3 pictures where he traveled in time and saw his younger self. The Kid, which is a comedy, in 2000, and Looper, which I believe was 2012. And, of course, 12 Monkeys. So we talked about Gilliam as the director. Another movie I shouldn't forget to mention is one I loved as a kid. I think I've seen it as an adult, Time Bandits.
I've never seen it.
But then so many duds beyond that. But then again, as we've said before, if you've made 3 good movies, I think this certainly fits that class. I'm not a big Brazil guy, but I get why other people are. And Fisher King. That right there. Plus, of course, doing all the Monty Python stuff as a writer and an actor and sometimes a director. Mentioned David Peoples and his wife, Janet. They're based on Chris Marquet or Marquer's 1962 short film, Le Jeté, which apparently Gilliam hadn't even seen. I love when people say that. I don't know if I really believe you. It's like when the Coen brothers said they had never read
The Odyssey
when they did O Brother, Where Art Thou, which takes so much from The Odyssey. Really? Come on, guys. I think you're just shitting us there.
Gilliam was a director for hire. This wasn't his vision. He usually writes his own films, but this was a script that the studio bought, and they thought Gilliam would just be perfect to direct it. So he was coming into the project.
One of the reasons why he worked with Universal again, despite the controversy with Brazil, is because it was different management as well.
And Brazil, for the record, is one of those movies that I do feel like I owe it a second chance. I wasn't really properly prepared for what kind of movie it was going to be like when I saw it, so I feel like I need to revisit it.
I've seen it at least twice, and I've never really truly latched onto it the way I did with this movie. I probably should have, because I think they're similar-ish, at least. Again, art directed up the ass in a great way, not a criticism at all, but also dank and dirty in a great way, in an appropriate way. And Jonathan Pryce is a hell of a good actor, and De Niro is fun in that movie. He's not fun in a lot of films, but he was in that one.
I might relate to the themes of it more now than I did when I saw it, because I was probably like 24 or something when I saw it.
Because you've changed, but the movie hasn't.
Exactly. And when you talk about red tape and how that can just bog you down and bureaucracy and how that can be evil and grind you down. Well, now in my 40s, I feel like I really would relate to those themes a lot more.
Also, the end of that movie, if I recall, is similar to what Joe Pantoliano's character is talking about in The Matrix, where he wants to go back in and be ignorant to what's going on in the real world. Which would you rather? The producer on 12 Monkeys was Charles Roven, who did Three Kings, which we covered last fall. Also The Dark Knight, which we covered a couple years ago. And he's also been involved in a ton of DC stuff, not just The Dark Knight. And it sounds like he and Gilliam worked really well together in this picture. I think they did the commentary together or something like that. Good producing work to get a guy who's known to be a little bit unreliable. Watching that documentary, Lost in La Mancha, part of the problem was him. Roven got him to make a movie that was profitable, which in the end is what the studio wants, and a movie that I think is also extremely artistic. It is 185:1. We watched the Blu-ray. I think we agree it looks pretty great. The cinematographer, Roger Pratt, shot Batman, which is one of the better-looking movies that didn't get nominated for an Oscar, also Brazil, and a few of the Harry Potter films. Loves those Dutch angles, a lot of tilted camera shots.
And some pretty wide lenses.
Yeah, Gilliam loves that. Also in Brazil.
It really got on my nerves after a while with the camera low and it's up the actor's nostrils. Mm. It just felt a little much.
The editor, Mick Audsley, cut Interview with the Vampire, which we covered last fall, the 1994 movie. So he saw a lot of Brad Pitt in a couple of years there. Also High Fidelity and other Stephen Frears films. Because High Fidelity was Stephen Frears. And the music was Paul Buckmaster, who's only written 11 scores, only composed 11. I don't love the score in general, but I always love that theme. So, what did you think of the music, the editing, and the look, the cinematography?
I uncharacteristically like the score.
Okay.
I like the weirdness of it and the moodiness.
It's very weird.
I think it fits the film perfectly. Cinematography, just express my opinion. It's just too much. I found it annoying.
Fair.
Those were some wide lenses.
But you love the sets, right? And the look of it in that
sense. The look of it is almost like the true star of the film. The true vision of the film comes through in the sets and the costumes. I love his vision of the future, which is filthy and breaking down and rusty and damp. Apparently, they wouldn't use any technology that wasn't available in 1996 when they made the film. They didn't have future technology, of course, except the time machine, which they're very vague about. Because they wanted to present a world where progress had stopped. They're desperate and they have to go back in time to find the answers to solve their problems because they just don't have the resources to solve their own problems. And it also really reminded me so much of Blade Runner. And of course, the screenwriter for Blade Runner is the co-writer of this film.
Peoples, yeah.
Yeah. Blade Runner, another very bleak, humorless film about the future with some absolutely exceptional
set design. Humor here, though, at least.
There is a little bit of humor.
It can be funny.
Ultimately, a pretty serious film. Especially for a Terry Gilliam film, it's pretty grounded and serious. I don't think it really has jokes baked in. They just happen accidentally, it seems. I really love the set design. If you're going to talk about what the greatest strength of this film is, it's just one innovative image after another. Incredible things. A lion on the roof of the library? Was that building?
I think it might be the Philadelphia Art Museum or the library or something.
Oh my gosh, those images. Him in that clear cellophane suit with what looks like Christmas lights. And it's kind of ridiculous and over the top, but it's striking and beautiful. It's so creative. And that is his true genius. And even with my pretty mediocre review of the film, I would still recommend that anybody should watch it for that alone. Because it's just such an interesting and creative piece of art.
And you know the funny thing is, I mentioned Roger Pratt shot Batman, which is such a great-looking film and everything. The only Oscar that won, or even was nominated for, were the sets. Not cinematography, not that great score by Danny Elfman. So sometimes the movies that last the longest, and maybe not for you, but this movie I think has lasted for a lot of people, are the ones you look back and say, why wasn't that recognized with more Oscars or with a bigger audience? This did have the audience. I talked about the critical reception. All those things were really good. But at the time, at least, not the Oscar recognition. But then Pitt going to the show, he won the Golden Globe, so you get some star power there.
And the Oscars doesn't often reward innovation either.
Okay, we probably missed about 100 things we could talk about with 12 Monkeys, but I think we'll wrap there. One of my favorite time travel movies, or is it? And again, as we end this podcast, I'm not really sure how I feel about whether or not they time traveled, meaning them all. Because supposedly, so did Jones, and so did Jose. It wasn't just James Cole. JC, Jesus Christ. Anyway, last thoughts on 12 Monkeys.
Don't let my opinion stop you from recommending this movie to anybody or going back and rewatching it. I'm glad we watched it. I'm glad we talked about it. It's a super interesting movie with a lot of valuable things in it that just don't happen to appeal to me personally.
I also love Gilliam's style more here than ever before, not to mention Bruce Willis's performance, which is definitely one of his very best. It's too bad he doesn't keep on doing stuff like this. Part of the problem with him, too, we didn't say this already, forgetting about being a Republican, forgetting about people not liking him that much. He seems like he's just lazy. Half the time, it's his stunt double doing any scene, even a simple dialogue scene from behind. You see that bald head. That's another thing at this point. I think he's fully shaved his head in this movie, right? And he wasn't always doing that back then. He still would have hair in movies. So there's a vanity thing. I guess he's got vanity like any actor, but he's had that receding hairline since he was young. Hell, even in the moonlighting days, he started having receding hair. So it's pretty good that he's looking as awful as he does, like I said before, but also tattoos on his head, no hair whatsoever. It's not a movie star performance, and maybe that's what makes it even better than it would have been if it had been Nick Nolte. Strange choice, huh? And Bridges playing the pit role would have been a whole different thing, but I'm curious about that now.
Yeah, it's tough to imagine. It would be a very different movie.
Okay, in 7 days, it will be September 28th, and we'll get a little ahead of Scary Movie Month as we talk about Roman Polanski's Repulsion, which Bev has not seen, but Repulsion is a creepy movie at the very least, from 1965. Catherine Deneuve, interesting French actress, but in an English language film. The coming attraction's opinion question, yet again an opinion. What's your favorite movie about a person losing their mind while stuck inside an apartment?
Okay, so for our answers to that question, check out our next podcast about Repulsion. And in the meantime, you can check out our website, top100project.com. You can also favorite or subscribe to the Top 100 Project on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or Spotify, where hundreds of episodes are available for free, and that includes all 123 movies that made the AFI's 1998 and or 2007 list of the best American films ever made, and lots more titles on top of that. In exchange for all that great content, perhaps you could leave us a rating and a review that helps people find us. If you want to reach us, we're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. Or you can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project. And that's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
Quick note, by the way, Chris and I, 9 more days, will be on the Top 100 Project. And after that, I'm taking them all down. And if you want to find Scoring at the Movies, our 60-ish episodes, whatever it'll be at that point, you'll have to go to Scoring at the Movies in various places. Of course, the ones you just said, but also TuneIn and Amazon and I forget what else. Chris got us everywhere. So please continue going to the Scoring at the Movies episodes, the sports movie podcast that was on this channel for all this time. But soon, very soon, it won't be here anymore. My last word on 12 Monkeys is... monkeys! Oh, fox. Monkeys.
And cut.